Hello, everyone. This is the About Townshipers show. We bring together people from all over the beautiful Eastern Townships who are working hard to improve the lives of English speakers in the region. Whether it's an organization helping youth to succeed in school, or a local writer who captures townships' history in his books, we highlight the vibrancy of this community. Stick around. This is About Townshipers. Today, on About Townshipers, we're going to discuss an organization called Calax des Rivières Haute-Yamaska and Bromissisquoi, also known in English as the Sexual Assault Support and Prevention Center. Calax is an organization taking a feminist approach to sexual assault prevention and support. To discuss the important work that they do, I'd like to welcome to the show the counselor and prevention program facilitator at Calax, Vanessa Bergeron. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for coming on. First off, what is Calax for people who don't know about it, and what role do you play in the community?
Yeah, so as you said, Calax is a support and prevention center for sexual assault victims. We've been around for almost 40 years now. This year will be our 40th anniversary. I'm 39, so obviously I haven't been there from the start, but two of my colleagues have. We are a nonprofit organization. We cover the entirety of the Haute-Yamaska and Bromissisquoi region. All of our services are free of charge, fully confidential, offered in both English and French. We have offices in Granby and offices in Cowansville, but we also drive around a lot. So we work simultaneously on, I'd say, three different main components. The first one is direct support. So we offer support to anybody who's 12 years old or older and who has identified or was socialized at one point or another in their lifetime as a girl or woman. So that includes girls, women, non-binary people, trans people as well, so trans men, trans women, and who was a victim of sexual violence. So regardless of the form, so it could be rape, but also sexual harassment, cybersexual assault, unwanted touching. So counseling services can be done individually or in small groups. And our counselors can also meet with family members, parents, partners, loved ones who wish to be as supportive as possible, but don't always know how to react when there's a recent disclosure of sexual assault. So that's the first component, which is direct support. The second component is prevention work. So we go around in different high schools and we facilitate prevention workshops. We have seven of them in total on different themes. There's one on consent, one on the various forms of sexual violence. There's one on gender stereotypes, hypersexualized culture. So we have a bunch of workshops in our prevention program that we offer.
And for prevention, that would be with both boys and girls?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So we that's for everybody for sure. And when we talk about, for example, certain myths, it's important for us to deconstruct some myths for boys as well, right? Because although the majority of victims of sexual violence are girls and women, it's also very often minors and children. So there are a lot of boys who are victims of sexual violence, and certain myths such as having an erection means you're consenting, is important to deconstruct with the boys as well. And there's a lot of prevention to be done with boys, because when we think about sexual violence as kind of stemming from gender stereotypes and gendered socialization, it affects everyone and everyone's involved. So we need to address this collectively. Mm-hmm. So that's our second component. We offer a lot of workshops. Sometimes we do kiosks. We're going to be here in Knowlton for a Family Fun Day in May, but we go around the area. And the third component is social justice and rights advocacy. So what we do mainly is organize events for important dates during the year, such as March 8th, which is the International Day, Women's Rights Day. There's also a Day of Action to Eliminate Violence Against Women in September. So we organize marches, events, activities for our members and for the general public. Sometimes we write opinion letters. We have a small magazine that we create twice a year. So there's a lot that we do on that front as well to aim for social change.
So you have a component that is more kind of counseling and support focused. You have a component that is educational and prevention focused, and another component that is more outreach focused and advocacy focused.
Exactly. Yeah. And we also have a special project called Agathe, like the precious stone, with which we support and accompany women who wish to get out of prostitution or any situation of sexual exploitation. So that's another, it's not one of our main components, but it's a project that we have been focusing on a lot in the past few years.
Oh, that's interesting. That's kind of like a...
like a side project, but it's also very... That project is very important to us. It's very dear to us. There's a lot of demand for prevention workshops on this topic because there's a lot of minors that are being recruited in the area.
Yeah.
Prostitution works... Like, the average age of entering prostitution in Canada is 14.
Wow.
It's very young, so... Yeah. We really want to support girls and women who wish to get out of that sex industry if they want to.
And that's counting like other things in the sex industry, including like camming and stuff like that.
Absolutely. Yeah, all forms of sexual exploitation. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So Vanessa, you're a counselor and prevention program facilitator. What does your role entail? And could you tell us a little bit also about your background and how you got drawn into this work?
Yeah.
Towards this work, I should say.
Absolutely. I've been working for nonprofits most of my career. I started out facilitating prevention workshops, but for the prevention of violence, like all forms of violence against children. So I used to work in daycare centers and elementary schools. I'm a workshop facilitator at heart. That's what I enjoy doing the most. So whenever I do that, especially in schools, that's when I'm in my comfort zone. And the organization that I worked for 6-7 years, which was in another region, it was in Chaudière-Appalaches, they actually were created by the CALACS. It was kind of a sister or an organization kind of thing. So it was the same approach. It was the same social analysis, the same empowerment methods that they used. And I really fell in love with that. I fell in love with community work, the idea of challenging power dynamics, power structures, challenging hierarchy. I love that. So for me, it really is about having a job that's in line with my values. Mm-hmm. I took a brief detour the past couple of years. I worked in publishing for a while. But I had to, like, when I moved to the Eastern Townships, I just had to come back to community work. That's where my heart is. And at CALACS, what's fun is that every day is different. That's what's great about our work. It's what's hard, but it's also what's great about our work. Like on a busy day, I can drive to a school, facilitate a workshop, come back to the office, have a counseling session with a woman, then have a meeting with my team or facilitate a support group or get some training on something relating to our mission. Like every day is different. There's like not one day is the same in our job.
Oh, wow. So that sounds incredibly dynamic and
it is.
A lot of fun, a lot of work.
No, but it's fun, actually. Yeah. Because of our approach, it's not as heavy as people think it is.
Yeah.
Like most of the time when I tell people that I work with survivors of sexual assault, they're like, oh, that must be really hard. But it can be, obviously. Mm-hmm. Like we do hear some trauma. There is that compassion, like fatigue that comes in when you work as a counselor, when you do social work in general, I think. But for me, the fact that there is that prevention aspect balances it out a lot. And also, and I think we're going to talk about the feminist approach that we have. But because of that approach, it's all about claiming our power back. It's all about empowering women to make changes in their lives. And so that's actually quite fun when you think about it. It's not a full hour of just crying and delving into trauma. Like that's not what we do at all. It's mostly about identifying consequences of assault and working on those and finding ways to control the narrative some more.
Yeah. That's a very good perspective on it, actually, because I think maybe some of the people who... Where people lead towards burnout or have like challenges with that, maybe sometimes in the social work field, or it's not because there's too much work or because it's too much trauma. It's often because they don't see that there's an impact from their work, and you get an opportunity to see the impact, I'm guessing.
Yeah, we really do. Whether it's in individual support or small groups, like yeah. we do love the small group approach, the support groups, because we create like a micro society where people learn to trust again. We create that safe space. We provide it. So we see it directly, like the impact of that for sure. But yeah, we see that on a daily basis, the impact of our work. Of course, like there are sessions and meetings where I go home and I cry for an hour. That happens to everyone, I think. But there's also beauty in that compassion. There's also beauty in that connection that we, that bond that we create with the women. And that's also part of our social analysis and our approach. You know, it's healing together, not alone on your own.
So how, it says on your mission that you're first and foremost a feminist organization. What is a feminist approach to extremely broad to a certain degree? Because you hit a lot of topics, but what does it entail for Kalax?
So for people who might not know, a feminist approach is a way of looking at oppression, right? So in this case, the issue of sexual violence, and by analyzing first and then challenging the way that gender inequality affects us. So what we seek to do at Kalax is transform certain power structures, create an environment that really is safer for everyone and that fosters empowerment. So what we do, everything we do at Kalax is done by women for women. Mm-hmm. We, as counselors, we position ourselves as equals with survivors, not experts. They are the experts of what they've been through, of their needs, of their boundaries, of what they wish to work on and what they want support with. So obviously we do have that power of information in a way, but we don't want to use that in a kind of teacher-student dynamic that you see a lot in the system or with therapists or through the CLSC. The system creates that dynamic, which we don't like because we want to challenge that. We think that a lot of issues come from that are caused by it. So we basically help them figure out like how they want to address the consequences of assault, because oftentimes it feels like those consequences have taken over your life. They're in the driver's seat and you no longer are. So how can we get some control over that? When women come into our offices, they enter some kind of moral contract with themselves in a way. They will establish a realistic goal and find ways to empower themselves to change things in their lives so that they feel stronger, so that they feel like they're healing. And the small group option, which we call actually groupe de changement, so groups that focus on change, that's the ideal way in our opinion, for them to heal, because it recognizes that this is not just one person's individual problem. Mm-hmm. It's a social problem that we should tackle collectively.
Mm-hmm. So you're avoiding the kind of doctor-patient dynamic?
Oh, yes, yeah. We are. And that's usually the first thing that I tell people when they come into my office. I'm not a therapist. I will not do like an intervention plan for you, and I will not tell you what to do. I'm here to support you with your goals and how you want to tackle them. So we do use, in our support process, we use notions from something that's called radical therapy. Mm. It sounds scary, but it's really not. Radical just means looking at the root of the problem, right? Mm. So when you think about certain mental health difficulties in the system, sometimes you will have people just talking about, for example, borderline personality disorder, and they will pathologize that and talk about it from an individual perspective, I think, or look at individual factors in the person's life. But very often they will not talk about the fact that a lot of times borderline personality disorder actually comes from complex trauma in childhood. Mm-hmm. And so there's that to address. And there's the whole idea that all of those things are rooted in social oppression. So for us to look at things like something that's called internalized judgment, we call them flics in French, like cops, if you will, because they're judgments that we've sort of recorded and that we keep repeating to ourselves. So beauty standards for women, like that's a classic example of that, of those internalized judgments. So thinking that if you gain weight, you're unlovable, you're not beautiful, you're not desirable. Where does that come from? That does not come from within. That comes from society, and we've internalized that, and that keeps hurting us over time. So there's a lot of those things that we can look at together and question those judgments and be like, well, do you still agree with that? Like, how do you feel about that? Where does that come from? Like, what, when was the first time that it hurt you? And how do we free ourselves from that? So women are socialized in a way that doesn't really encourage self-affirmation, that we're not really taught to assert ourselves a lot or to feel or express anger. For men, it's a whole other thing. Like, it's not better. It's just very different. But we are socialized in very different ways. And so it's not surprising when you hear that most victims are children and women, because we have less power and we are taught to find value in caring for others, ignoring sometimes some danger signals within that come from within. And so that's a lot of the work that we do with women, is learning to trust yourself, to assert yourself, to put some boundaries, and also to just question and challenge some of those judgments or the power dynamics that we all use. Like, we also use the Cartman drama triangle, where we adopt roles, like we take on roles like the rescuer, the persecutor, the victim. And we switch roles quite often, like and we hear people say, oh, I'm a rescuer. Yeah, sure, because as women, we're, that's the role that's valued the most. But we all tend to switch, like during one argument you can switch like 10 times, switch roles 10 times. But that's a way of trying to control what we cannot control or trying to feel valued. So again, looking at that, analyzing that in our lives is a fun way of claiming our power back.
Yeah. Do you look at root traumas and some of the, you mentioned you look at root traumas and kind of some of the issues behind some maybe mental health issues. Is the goal behind this, behind going more at the base cause and also societal causes, to help these women to build more confidence and understand a little bit better that it's not like their fault? Or
absolutely. That's where I was going. It's getting rid of that guilt. The guilt and the shame is the top one probably consequence that's identified by survivors. And that guilt, again, doesn't always come from within. Shame is socially induced. Shame is something that comes from others and their way of looking at us. And very often, victims of sexual assault will be treated or perceived like it's was somehow their fault, unless it's like you're walking in a park at midnight and a stranger attacks you, then they'll be like, oh, poor you. But most, we know that that's the rare one. That's one of the misconceptions that we have because of movies and just in general the fact that we don't talk about sexual assault openly. But the vast majority of sexual assault experiences will be committed by someone we know, right? Someone we trust, someone we love, even. That's very complex. So a lot of times when people disclose sexual assault, the way that they are received is with reactions. Like, sometimes people will play detectives, try to figure out what happened, if it was assault or not. It's, I mean, that's not our job. Or they will question, like, well, did you say no? Like, she should have said no. She should have dressed differently. She shouldn't have, like, gotten that drink or went to that party or flirted with that person even. But, I mean, it can be sexual assault, even if it's with a romantic partner or with a family member, you know? Even if you love that person, or even if your body reacts a certain way, or even if, like, consent is something that's always fun for me to talk about, because we understand it, but in a very simple way. Like, yes means yes and no means no. But like, there's so much nuance there. There's so much complexity in the way that we apply it, the way that we understand it, the way that we even respect our own consent sometimes or not. So that's what we like to address in prevention workshops with teenagers. It's like, are you doing this because of the pressure that is put on you or that you're putting on yourself? Or are you doing this because you want to?
Yeah. Because you're playing a role instead of being true to your feelings and your...
Absolutely, yeah. So, and there are reasons why we do that. You know, we do that because we want to feel loved, because we want to feel a sense of belonging, because we don't want to be rejected. There's different reasons. So, like, deconstructing all of that is pretty hard, right? Yeah. Like, getting rid of that guilt, of that shame, it's not something that we can do in one meeting or in one workshop, obviously. But we have a lot of tools that we use, like in individual support or in support groups. We use nonviolent communication a lot. We use self-compassion. fashion a lot. So authentic expression, those are things that make it easier. We have very little practice with them because as in society, we don't, it's not very common to see people applying those. But when we start exploring it, it's very healing and it's very reassuring. Yeah. It's much easier to feel, to just be yourself and be authentic and assert yourself and in the end, protect yourself and others.
Yeah. And nonviolent communication is a very empowering tool for people to learn. For people who don't know what that is, it's a form of, well, communication style that was designed as a way of kind of taking full ownership of your feelings with regards to of your feelings and your needs and expressing those to other people as your needs and as your feelings rather than talking to somebody else as if they're the cause. You're taking full ownership and it's really like rooted in building empathy and lines of empathy between people so that they're fully able to understand each other a little bit better instead of getting into a kind of defensive argument.
Very well explained. Yeah, it's all about empathy, but it's all about introspection first and taking the time. We don't take time when we communicate. We speak over each other. We don't listen. We don't listen to ourselves. And so I always tell people, like, the first step of nonviolent communication is communicating with yourself and feeling that empathy towards yourself. That's the biggest part of it, in my opinion, because after that, it's no longer all in your control, right? You don't control the outcome of whether or not the other person will want to work on that with you, will collaborate. So, but that first part is so important, and it really does make a difference when you apply it in your daily life and when you communicate in that way. It's kind of, instead of triggering bombs, it like diffuses them.
Yeah.
So it's, I love nonviolent communication. I'm a huge like Marshall Rosenberg fan.
Yeah, likewise. And well, it sounds like you're like Kalax offers an incredible array of resources for women who are in need of empowerment or in need of support. And I think that's fantastic, Vanessa. We're going to just take a quick break here and listen to a quick song, a favorite of mine. This is Rising by Lassa DeSella.
Storm and carried away. I got turned around. I got caught in the storm. That's what happened to me. So I didn't call, and you didn't see me for a while. I was rising. Breaking.
Welcome back to About Townshippers on CIDI 99.1 FM and CJMQ 88.9 FM. We're here with Vanessa Bergeron from Calax des Rivières, and we're talking about all things to do with sexual assault prevention, and we were just discussing a little bit about communication styles. Vanessa, I'm wondering, when you're working as a counselor, when you're in your counseling sessions, you mentioned earlier that it's important for women to kind of guide things. How do you ensure that you don't fall into this power dynamic of you being the wise one teaching somebody? And how do you ensure that women's choices and their pace and their experiences are respected?
That will vary a lot depending on the person that's in front of me, to be honest. But I've realized that I have like two working modes, two mindsets. One is facilitating and leading, and the other is listening and connecting. Mm-hmm. So again, like we've just talked about nonviolent communication, about self-empathy, about empathy. So taking the time to ground ourselves, to listen to one another, to make sure that they feel heard, to me that's the first step in doing so. Because if the person hears you kind of lead too much, mm-hmm. they will fall into that like student role or yeah. patient role, and we don't want that to happen. So there will be sometimes with very shy people or people who are very used to that role, we will have awkward moments of just mm-hmm. me waiting or asking again the same mm-hmm. question. But that's a good thing, because it create space for them to speak up and to tell us what they want, what they need, what they wish, what direction they wish this to go in. And that can take a couple of sessions for certain people, and for others it's like a breath of fresh air, and they're like, oh, finally, like nobody's telling me what to do, I get to lead this. Obviously we support them with it. We have a ton of like tools and things that we can print and things that we can do during sessions, but it will always be them leading, because they need to feel like they're in control of things. And there's no other way of doing that, in my opinion. I think we're lucky because we're kind of out on the outskirts of the system. We only support survivors who actively wish and seek our support. Yeah. So that means, for example, a person whose parents really want her to have a meeting with us, if she's not ready, if she doesn't want to, if she's feeling that pressure, we'll just be like, hey, here's our number. We can have that welcome meeting if you want. I can tell you how we work. That way it might be less stressful in the future. But if you're not feeling it right now, that's fine. Mm. There's no time limit. Same goes for that whole like filing a complaint or pressing charges. That's not something that they have to do. And that's something that there's no time limit for. So there's no way that we will push for that to happen. We know how hard it is to do that for survivors. So the fact that we will meet them where they're at, and that we will listen to them and to what they want, what they need, what they feel capable of, where they feel capable of making changes. And if they do face, like they're facing a wall with either, sometimes it's a loved one that's not being supportive, sometimes it's the system, or, you know, mm-hmm. pressing charges and facing that result, which is very frustrating, because the whole justice system is very flawed when it comes to sexual violence. It's very like you have to prove without the hint of a doubt that there was no consent or that it wasn't valid. That's yeah. impossible. It's very often your word against mine. Most of the time there are no witnesses. So like yeah. I've met with women who, like, I've seen the bruises and the, like, they've had like the hospital rape kit done, and still the prosecutor didn't want to move forward with the charges. So that's frustrating. And when that happens, we're frustrated with them. We use that anger, you know, we use that energy towards something more constructive, but we do address it as something that's very unfair and very frustrating, instead of saying just, you know, well, that's life, move on. Because yeah. most of the time that's what people around you will say, because they're feeling uncomfortable. We've done everything we could, we're facing a wall. But yeah. taking that time to express the anger, to feel it, to understand where it comes from, to know that it's legitimate, that can be very helpful and supportive for people.
Yeah, yeah. Do you take referrals, or you're outside? Yeah, you do take referrals.
Yeah, we do take referrals, but yeah. we, so the way that we work is, whether it's a referral or someone calling in, first thing we do is make sure that it's us they wanted to reach out to, because it's very easy to mix up acronyms. There's CAVAC, there's CALACS, there's EVAC. They all sound the same. So we make sure that we're the right resource, that they identify as a girl, woman, trans person, etc. Like that our mission works for them, that our approach works for them, because we can also refer to other organizations for men, such as CHAZ in the Eastern Townships, that does the same thing, same approach, but with boys and men. So that's the first thing we do. But if we are the right resource for them, we'll set up a what you could call, I guess, an intake meeting, but it's really a welcome meeting that we call it, where we explain the way we work. They tell us not about their trauma. We only need the context of sexual assault. We used trauma-informed care, so that's what we apply, which means that you don't need to go into details. I don't need to know everything that happened. I don't want you to relive anything traumatic that you've been through or to have to prove anything. So I only need the context, like who was this person to you? How long did it last? How old were you? Did you tell anybody? How did they react, etc.? What consequences, what difficulties are you identifying now? Because sometimes they show up at our office and they're 70 years old and we're the first people they've told, right? So it's very different from one person to the other. But mainly what we do is make sure that our approach works for them and that they're willing participants in this. And so with referrals, that's usually where we can sometimes tell that the person won't want to continue on for now or not at all. So we'll do that first welcome meeting, no pressure. If they wish to be added on our wait list, we have a short wait list. We're nine counselors, so the wait list isn't very long currently, but that can change, right, depending on the number of calls that we get every week. But we take contact info, we mark down if they want to do the support groups or individual meetings. If they want to do individual, then it's once every 2 weeks, about an hour long, up to 10 sessions. Mm-hmm. For support groups, it's 15 weeks in a row, 3 hours a week. So that's a big commitment. So it really is up to them, depending on what they want. They can sign up for both and see like which comes first. They can do one and then do the other. That's fine. They just can't do both at the same time because then it would be overwhelming for everyone.
Yeah.
But yeah, so with referrals, like we do take a lot of them. Sometimes it's a social worker. Sometimes it's a school psychologist, a therapist, a sexologist. Sexologist. Anyway.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's parents. When it's parents, we are extra cautious to make sure that it's, when it's teenagers, we really want to make sure that it's their decision. So we do show up at school, so they don't have to miss class. They miss class, but I mean, they don't have to drive to the office or do it outside of school hours. And so that it remains confidential, so we can drive around to different schools and meet with teenagers there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that first meeting will be very important for us to just make sure that it's their decision.
Does it take a little while, particularly with teenagers, to build trust?
Actually, it's quite the opposite, I'd say.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because it's, I think our defense mechanisms as adults are sometimes more...
developed?
Yeah, developed or harder to pierce through or something. Like, it's hard to let our guard down sometimes when we've dealt with things the same way for a long, long time. And what we see a lot with teenagers is we are that resource, that one resource where they don't have to do anything. They're not obligated to do anything. It's not pressure. There's not that pressure of performing, of being told what to do. Like,
yeah. It's an opportunity to exhale. And,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So like they enjoy the fact that we're like, well, if you don't want to see me again, that's fine with me. I won't take it personally, you know? I will not partake in the intervention plan thing with the TS, from the school or the parents or the principal. Like, I'm not a part of that. I'm really outside of that, and I'm here for you.
Yeah.
And for what you want. So sometimes it's easier to build trust with teenagers. And so we have a thing where we, when the person is under 18, we have a list of exceptions for certain realities where they don't go on a wait list. So because they're in an especially vulnerable position or situation. And so for minors, that's what we apply. We see them right away, and we'll start with like 5 meetings. We'll take it really one meeting at a time, and if they want more, then they can go on like a short wait list for youth.
Yeah. It's like an emergency call. You push your other.
Well, it's not an emergency call, but it's a way for us to address to make sure that we apply the intersectional approach, where we recognize that some people are like the social identities and political identities, like race, age, economic background, like those can intersect and create a different reality, like a very unique combination of discrimination or privilege for everyone. And so we do have a list of exceptions to the wait list. For instance, people who are refugees or who've been here for less than 5 years, people living with a disability, and people under the age of 18, we'll make sure that we see them right away. If the sexual assault event happened happened last night or 2 weeks ago, like we'll see them without them having to wait. Then there's the matter of like, are they ready? Do they want to? But if they're willing to start right away, we will.
Mm-hmm. So you have different categories of kind of risk assessment.
Yeah, I guess so. Well, it's not just risk assessment. It's mostly just recognizing that these people are more isolated, or they're facing more discrimination in their daily lives. So it really depends on the situation. I can't really tell you like for all of those exceptions, but it's a way for us to be as inclusive and as intersectional as we can in our approach. Yeah.
Okay, right on. That's important to recognize that it's not just gender's one component, right?
There's gender, there's race, there's poverty, there's disability, there's so many, like I forget, like there, I don't know if you've seen the like the Wheel of Privilege. You can Google it if you want. There's a whole wheel that exists where it really helps you visualize what intersectionality is, where you're just at a different intersection of the same web, but it affects you differently.
Yeah.
So we try to make sure that we never forget this. And I mean, the language is one too, right? If you're not speaking the same language as the majority around you.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, intersectionality is like the idea originally looking at black women in the United States. It can be applied to any group, that your various factors of your identity intersect to create a different reality and different disadvantages and advantages to a certain degree, but mostly disadvantages in life. For example, feminism for black women is different than feminism for white women, as an example.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So we'll take just a quick little break and listen to another song, and then we'll be right back with Vanessa Bergeron from Calax.
Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ladies, 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 ladies. Ooh, my nation's on the looming effect and the parallax view and the figure and the form and the revolving door. Keeps turning out more and more good women like you. Yet another woman to whom I won't get through. Ooh, my nation's on the looming effect and the parallax view and the figure and the form and the revolving door that keeps turning out more and more good women like you. Yet another woman to whom I won't get through. Ladies, 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 take it easy when he leaves me. Please be my guest. Do whatever I might have left in his kitchen cupboards, in the back of his bathroom cabinets. And oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, there's a dress in the closet. Don't get rid of it. You look good. I didn't fit in it. It was never mine. It belonged to the ex-wife. of another ex of mine. She left it behind with a note, one line. It said, I don't know if I'm coming across, but I'm really trying. She was very kind. Ooh.
That was Ladies by Fiona Apple, and we're here on About Townshippers on CIDI 99.1 FM and CJMQ 88.9 FM, and I'm here speaking with Vanessa Bergeron from CALAX, which is the Sexual Assault Support Center here in Brome, Missisquoi, but also Otyamaska, you cover. We were just discussing a little bit about intersectionality, the role of people's identities and people's upbringings and backgrounds, and their risk of sexual assault. And I was wondering, how do you create an inclusive, like you mentioned that you welcome certain groups, you'll allow them to kind of skip the line or you'll prioritize them. But what are the different ways that you create an inclusive environment for women from different cultural, social, and economic backgrounds?
Yeah, there are different ways that we try to achieve that. Being in a rural setting, that's not always easy to do, but we do our best. I think the fact that our services are all free and confidential really helps with that. We have in the past paid for transportation, like bus tickets, for people who had no means of transportation. The fact that we offer our services in both languages is one, that we drive around. Like, we have two offices, but we also drive. Sometimes we can use a room in a CLSC or a volunteering center in a different town, mm-hmm. because we cover a large area. We also work closely with an organization called Cerie, which supports the immigrant population. So I have colleagues who actually go in there and offer custom workshops to their users. And so that allows us to reach women who sometimes wouldn't even know, like, otherwise wouldn't know we exist.
Yeah. Right? So you work with other community organizations?
We really do. Yeah. They actually provide interpreters for us as well. Cerie, we work with Divergent, for people from the LGBTQ plus community. Mm-hmm. We use a lot of inclusive writing. There are things that we do to make sure that it feels accessible and inclusive for everyone. We've changed our mission statement in the past couple of years because before it just said girls and women. Mm-hmm. Now it says anybody who's ever socialized as a girl or a woman, mm-hmm. at one point or another in their lifetime. So that includes a lot more people.
Yeah.
And we do offer welcome meetings. Like, if the person's not sure, we'll just book a welcome meeting and see how you feel about it. And we'll tell you about how we work and our approach and our social analysis of sexual violence, and if it works for you, then it works for you.
Do you think women here in the Eastern Township, do you think English-speaking women here in the Eastern Townships experience added challenges when it comes to communicating about sexual violence?
I think so, yeah. I think there's an added level of isolation, of social isolation, when you speak a different language. Even if English is, you know, the lingua franca, the main, like, spoken language in the world, we're still in a rural environment. We're still in Quebec. And that is sometimes frowned upon. That's sometimes even seen as, like, a cultural threat by people. Mm-hmm. So it can feel isolating. So, and there's also that feeling of not being fully understood when talking about things that are very intimate and very close to your heart. So, I mean, a lot of people in Quebec claim to be bilingual on paper, but when it comes to seeking help, psychological support, it really does make a difference when you feel like you can speak freely about your feelings in your own language, knowing the person in front of you isn't just trying to decipher what you're saying, but is actually understanding and connecting with you.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard it a lot from English-speaking people in the area when I meet with them, because they're like, oh, yeah, I prefer, like, I'm bilingual, but I prefer talking about this in English, making sure that it's understood. And we're lucky right now because out of the 9 counselors, there's 4 of us that can work in English, and there's even one that can work in Spanish. So
yeah. Oh, that's great. That's really important, because I think that's one of the things that we have encountered at Townshippers Association, mm-hmm. when working with the English-speaking community, is people saying, well, I don't know where to find resources, yeah. or, like, I'm worried that I'm going to end up having to translate everything or mm-hmm. speak in French the whole time. And you make a good point. I mean, I think we looked at 78% of Anglophones in the Eastern Townships are self-defined as bilingual, mm-hmm. but it isn't the same thing.
No,
it isn't the same thing when you're talking about a difficult subject.
No, and we can code switch. I mean, I'm bilingual. My first language is French, obviously. So, like, when we speak and we're both bilingual, we can just code switch and, like,
yeah,
use little shortcuts and know the other person will understand us. But it still feels a lot more comfortable to be talking about your traumatic experiences, about your feelings, about things that are very intimate in your own language. It does make a difference.
Yeah, for sure.
When it comes to trust, like, trust is huge with for sexual violence survivors. So it's easier to connect and to build trust, I think.
Oh, man. Well, I was wondering if there's a listener that's listening to this show who has experienced sexual violence. I would like to know what would you want to tell them?
I believe you. 0% of what happened was your fault. 0%. I always say that. None of it. You do not have to carry all of this alone. You can take your time. It does take time. But we'll take that time together. And you are not alone. Mm-hmm. So those are the main points that we believe in. We can address this collectively. We can work on this together. We can aim for social change together so that less and less people have to go through that. And going through that in silence, not talking about it for years, that's a huge weight that we shouldn't carry ever.
Mm-hmm. And those phrases like, I believe you, mm-hmm. and it's not your fault, or it's a 0% of it, it's your fault. Yeah. Would you suggest those phrases as a good approach for people who are trying to support survivors if a survivor comes towards you and is expressing themselves?
Absolutely. Those are because we do have a workshop on supporting victims, and those are the key phrases like that I usually tell students. I'm like, it's not a magical, like, it won't fix everything, but it's not your job to fix everything either. And it's not your job to play detective or to figure out what happened or to have them tell you everything or to save that person either. But the most impactful thing that you can do is respect their pace, believe them, make sure they understand that it wasn't their fault. Tell them how brave it was to talk about it and how are you here for them. You can, you know, walk with them to the nurse's office in the school, or you can call the Kallax with them if you're a parent or a loved one. You can, if you're a partner, you can even meet with us and we'll be happy to help you support the person. We love meeting with family members and partners and parents. Like those are great meetings for us because they also need something. They also need to talk about it and process things. They also face sometimes that guilt, but it's a different kind of guilt, and the survivor shouldn't have to deal with it. Yeah. So we're here for that as well.
Yeah. Well, I think that's excellent advice. And Vanessa Bergeron, you're doing fantastic work at Kallax. I think it's admirable. And I think anybody who's listening, who's interested about Kallax des Rivières, you should go and check them out on their website. Mm-hmm. If you're interested about any of their services, give them a call. Don't be shy.
Absolutely. You can email us if you prefer. We'll call you, though, if you email us, because we need to speak directly with you. But if that's easier, you can email us as well.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
You've been listening to About Townshippers. Episodes are broadcast on CIDI 99.1 FM on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. and again on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Episodes are also broadcast on CJMQ 88.9 FM Tuesdays at 10 a.m. and Thursdays at 4 p.m. Find us in the podcast and program section of CIDI 99.1 FM's website. A shout out to Yvon Grandin, our show's technician and editor. We're so lucky to have him. In fact, if you like classic rock, check out his show, The Ivan Hour, Tuesdays and Thursdays at 10 p.m. on CIDI 99.1 FM. My name's Nathaniel Lamont, and this has been About Townshippers. Take care. Just like children sleeping.